Namaste. Sri Aurobindo, in this chapter, the core of the teaching, is discussing the nature of duty. Outward, what we should do according to ethical doctrines, and inwards, how we should obey a higher law. And we take this up now as well. Duty, from what is due. In other words, it's an exchange. It is a transaction. It is the most external aspect of what is Dharma. Now, Sri Aurobindo, in this 500-page book, probably discusses Dharma 100 times. We'll have many opportunities to delve deeply into it, and you may have to endure an extended discussion about what is the nature of Dharma, Swadharma, and this won't be tonight. We're about halfway through the chapter. And Sri Aurobindo begins with this sentence in the remainder of the section. We must remember that duty is an idea which in practice rests upon social conceptions. We may extend the term beyond its proper connotation and talk of our duty to ourselves, or we may, if we like, say in a transcendent sense that it was Buddha's duty to abandon all, or even that it is the ascetic's duty to sit motionless in a cave. But this is obviously to play with words. Duty is a relative term and depends upon our relation to others. It is a father's duty as a father to nurture and educate his children, a lawyer's to do his best for his client, even if he knows him to be guilty and his defense to be a lie, a soldier's to fight and shoot to order, even if he kill his own kin and countrymen, a judge's to send the guilty to prison and hang the murderer. And so long as these positions are accepted, the duty remains clear, a practical matter of course, even when it is not a point of honor or affection and overrides the absolute religious or moral law. But what if the inner view is changed? If the lawyer is awakened to the absolute sinfulness of falsehood, the judge becomes convinced that capital punishment is a crime against humanity. The man called upon to battlefield feels like the conscientious objector of today, or as a Tolstoy would feel, that in no circumstances is it permissible to take human life any more than to eat human flesh. It is obvious that here the moral law, which is above all relative duties, must prevail. And that law depends on no social relation or conception of duty, but on the awakened inner perception of man, the moral being. And here again we come to a desideratum of Sri Aurobindo's philosophy, which is we must rely on our inner experience as it builds, upon our inner life, but ultimate guidance. We can't look to the shifting human conventions to provide for us real guidance. In the perplexities of time, they are an unsteady guide, even in calm times, they are the lowest possible denominator. What calls us to a higher life is what must be our concern, especially those of us who practice yoga. But here, Krishna is guiding Arjuna on a battlefield through the minefield, which is human ethical thinking, to get to a place where he can act confidently, clearly, in the fullness of his own soul, possessed of his being, of his nature, and in accord with what the divine demands. So Sri Aurobindo keeps driving this point. There are in the world, he writes, in fact, two different laws of conduct, each valid on its own plane, the rule principally dependent on external status, and the rule independent of status and entirely dependent on the thought and conscience. The Gita does not teach us to subordinate the higher plane to the lower. It does not ask the awakened moral consciousness to slay itself on the altar of duty as a sacrifice and victim to the law of the social status. It calls us higher and not lower. From the conflict of the two planes, it bids us ascend to a supreme poise above the mainly practical, above the purely ethical, to the Brahmic consciousness. It replaces the conception of social duty by a divine obligation. The subjection to external law gives place to a certain principle of inner self-determination of action, proceeding by the soul's freedom from the tangled law of works. And this, as we shall see, the Brahmic consciousness, the soul's freedom from works, and the determination of works in the nature by the Lord within and above us, is the kernel of the Gita's teaching with regard to action. And this is thrown into dismay. And roiled ethicists in India about the nature of the Gita's teaching. This Krishna fellow, look how he confounds what we have set down so carefully in law and text. And look how he behaves. Sri Aurobindo makes the point that Krishna may not always obey the laws of humanity. He may not act morally, but he always acts divinely. That is a higher guide. Here's this essential point. The Gita can only be understood, like any other great work of the kind, by studying it in its entirety and as a developing argument. We'll touch upon this often in the book. The Gita may have been a smaller group of verses at one point, which was then expanded upon, but look at the sense that it makes. Look at the coordination it makes to the advancing soul to graduate from one teaching to another, to exhaust one path before entering to another, then finally to bring all sinuous paths together in a synthetic whole. This is Sri Aurobindo's insight into the Gita, which justifies it as one of the most sublime texts of Vedanta we could possibly hold in our laps. But let's go forward. But the modern interpreters, starting from the great writer Bankim Chandra Chatterjee, who first gave to the Gita this new sense of a gospel of duty, have laid an almost exclusive stress on the first three or four chapters, and in those, on the idea of equality, on the expression kartavyam karma, the work that is to be done, which they render by duty, and on the phrase, thou hast a right to action, but none to the fruits of action, which is now popularly quoted as the great word, Mahavakya, of the Gita. Well, the idea that you have a right to the action, but not to the fruits, that's the second chapter, 47th shloka. Kartavyam karma is a phrase that does not actually occur in the Gita. I await your correction, if you can find it. I don't find it. The rest of the 18 chapters, with their high philosophy, are given a secondary importance, except indeed the great vision in the 11th. He's still talking about Chatterjee and the modern interpreters here. This is natural enough for the modern mind, which is, or has been until yesterday, inclined to be impatient of metaphysical subtleties and far-off spiritual seekings, eager to get to work, and like Arjuna himself, mainly concerned for a workable law of works, a dharma. But it is the wrong way to handle this scripture. Now, be patient with me. This next couple of paragraphs has many citations. It's worth noting them as we go. And maybe I'll say before we enter into it that remember that Sri Aurobindo had two things with him when he was in prison in Alipur for that year. He had a copy of the Gita and he had some of the Upanishads. He used the Upanishads to support his meditation practice. He had already realized the divine, but he was working on perfecting parts of his nature and used the Upanishads for that. But the Gita helped him lift his consciousness beyond mere spiritual attainment to a greater height. And how deeply he knew the Gita, I think, becomes evident as he rolls forth these two paragraphs. Let's go. The equality which the Gita preaches is not disinterestedness. The great command to Arjuna, given after the foundation and main structure of the teaching, have been laid and built. Arise, slay thy enemies, enjoy a prosperous kingdom, has not the ring of an uncompromising altruism or of a white dispassionate abnegation. It is a state of inner poise and wideness, which is the foundation of spiritual freedom. Arise, slay thy enemies. This is after the revelation of the cosmic divine. In chapter 11, this is shloka 33. And then the state of inner poise, the wideness as the foundation, that's chapter 4, shloka 42. With that poise, in that freedom, we have to do the work that is to be done. A phrase which the Gita uses with the greatest wideness, including in it all works, sarva karmani, and which far exceeds, though it may include, social duties or ethical obligations. So, the work that is to be done. Karyam Karma, chapter 3, shloka 19. And this occurs right before he begins to describe what it is that the divine worker must do to hold together the worlds, to hold together the people, loka sangraha. So translated into English, 3:19 says, devoting all yourself to me, giving up in your conscious mind all your actions to me, resorting to buddhi yoga, the yoga of the intelligent will, be always one in heart and consciousness with me. So already, here in the third chapter, this is a synthesis. One in the heart, one in consciousness, love and knowledge, but in action, giving up all your actions to me consciously, consciously offered. Consecrated, made sacred. So here's heart, mind, life at work, all attuned to that, all saying, here, this is yours. I seem to do it. Whatever is done is yours. So in Chetasa Sarva Karmani, with a clear conscious mind, all the works are given. What is the work to be done is not to be determined by the individual choice, nor is the right to the action and the rejection of claim to the fruit, the great word of the Gita, but only a preliminary word governing the first state of the disciple when he begins ascending the hill of yoga. By the way, I would also want to call your attention to chapter 11, shloka 33, for perhaps the broadest use of the term sarva karmani in the Gita. Back to his para here. It is practically superseded at a subsequent stage. For the Gita goes on to affirm emphatically that the man is not the doer of the action. It is prakriti. It is nature. It is the great force with its three modes of action that works through him. And he must learn to see that it is not he who does the work. This is chapter 3, shloka 5, and again, 27. Now, this is interesting. The man is not the doer of the action. The man is the literal translation of Purusha. So Purusha and Prakriti are distinct. And the three modes of action, sattva, rajas, tamas. Therefore, the right to action is an idea which is only valid so long as we are still under the illusion of being the doer. It must necessarily disappear from the mind, like the claim to the fruit, as soon as we cease to be to our own consciousness the doer of our works. All pragmatic egoism, whether of the claim to fruits or of the right to action, is then at an end. When you have this clear perception from deep within, that it is nature who is acting, needs not your authoritative sanction to do it, is being compelled from a higher law, then in a sense you're free, if you're stable in that recognition, from enchainment to ego, and therefore enchainment to the fruits. They don't belong to you because the work wasn't yours. So that's again chapter 2, shloka 47. But the determinism of prakriti is not the last word of the Gita. The equality of the will and the rejection of fruits are only means for entering with the mind and the heart and the understanding into the divine consciousness and living in it. And the Gita expressly says that they are to be employed as a means as long as the disciple is unable so to live or even to seek by practice the gradual development of this higher state. So equality of will, rejection of the fruits, chapter 3, shloka 30, giving up thy works to me, with thy consciousness founded in the self, free from desire and egoism, fight, delivered from the fever of thy soul. So he bids him back to action, the action of his nature. Also, when he says they are to be employed as a means, this is equality and rejection, so long as you're unable to live in it, that's chapter 12, shlokas 3 and 4, and also 11. And what is this divine, whom Krishna declares himself to be? It is the Purushottama, beyond the self that acts not, beyond the Prakriti that acts, foundation of the one, master of the other, the Lord of whom all is the manifestation, who even in our present subjection to Maya sits in the heart of his creatures, governing the works of Prakriti. He by whom the armies on the field of Kurukshetra have already been slain, while yet they live, and who uses Arjuna only as an instrument or immediate occasion of this great slaughter. So, chapter 4, shloka 10, chapter 8, 9 and 10, chapter 13, 27, chapter 18, yes, the close, 61, and chapter 11, 32 through 34. Prakriti is only his executive force. The disciple has to rise beyond this force and its three modes or gunas. He has to become trigunatita, in other words, to be beyond, literally, to transcend the three gunas. And that's chapter 14, shloka 25-26. Not to her has he to surrender his actions, the her being Prakriti, over which he has no longer any claim or a right, but into the being of the Supreme, reposing his mind and understanding, heart and will in him, with self-knowledge, with God-knowledge, with world-knowledge, with a perfect equality, a perfect devotion, an absolute self-giving, he has to do works as an offering to the master of all self-energizings and all sacrifice. Identified in will, conscious with that consciousness, that shall decide and initiate the action. This is the solution which the divine teacher offers to the disciple. So note, self-knowledge, God-knowledge, world-knowledge, the three terms of existence again, the awakened individual become aware of the transcendent, at one with the cosmic, the universal. The perfect devotion, all of this, chapter 3, shlokas 30 through 32. What the great supreme word of the Gita is, its Mahavakya, we have not to seek. For the Gita itself declares it in its last utterance, the crowning note of the great Diapason. With the Lord in thy heart, take refuge with all thy being. By his grace thou shalt attain to the supreme peace and the eternal status. So have I expounded to thee a knowledge more secret than that which is hidden. Further here, the most secret, the supreme word that I shall speak to thee. become my-minded, devoted to me. To me do sacrifice and adoration. Infallibly thou shalt come to me, for dear to me art thou. Abandoning all laws of conduct, seek refuge in me alone. I will release thee from all sin. Do not grieve. Indeed, the Mahavakya, the great word. And here, again, all three yogas, the three marga, the three paths, come into fusion in the overwhelming experience of oneness, identity with the divine, in the mind, my-minded, conscious, free, merged in that, devoted to me, in deep, heartfelt communion, doing sacrifice, motivated by that devotion. And this lifts you. When every part of your being obeys the divine law, lifts you beyond all laws, all dharmas, you are in that only. It is your foundation, Ashrita. The divine is your ashram. Released from error, because now you live divinely. And grief, sorrow, sense of loss, fear, gone. Abhaya, fear not, come to me. The argument of the Gita resolves itself into three great steps by which action rises out of the human into the divine plane, leaving the bondage of the lower for the liberty of a higher law. First, by the renunciation of desire and a perfect equality, works have to be done as a sacrifice by man, as the doer, a sacrifice to a deity who is the supreme and only self, though by him not yet realized in his own being. Secondly, not only the desire of the fruit, but the claim to be the doer of works has to be renounced in the realization of the self as the equal, the inactive, the immutable principle, and of all works as simply the operation of universal force, of the nature soul, prakriti, the unequal, active, mutable power. Lastly, the Supreme Self has to be seen as the Supreme Purusha, governing this prakriti, of whom the soul in nature is a partial manifestation, and by whom all works are directed in a perfect transcendence through nature. To him, love and adoration and the sacrifice of works have to be offered. The whole being has to be surrendered to him, and the whole consciousness raised up to dwell in this divine consciousness, so that the human soul may share in his divine transcendence of nature and of his works and act in a perfect spiritual liberty. This, of course, is reminiscent of what Sri Aurobindo set down in the book The Mother, as he wrote about work, this abandonment of the fruits, this abandonment of the separate self, this consignment of all into the divine, this identification with the divine, key to his own success and sadhana, perfected much of this when he was incarcerated in the Alipur jail, and then this accomplished, rising to new heights, being introduced to greater fields of conscious exploration above, And that consumed his efforts at sadhana for the rest of his life, to establish a new yoga, something that would integrate and transform nature. So, to him, love and adoration and the sacrifice of works have to be offered. The whole being has to be surrendered to him, and the whole consciousness raised up to dwell in this divine consciousness, so that the human soul may share in his divine transcendence of nature and of his works and act in a perfect spiritual liberty. You see, the connotation is there. The Gita leaves it implicit. He suggests more powerfully this possibility. The first step is karma yoga, the selfless sacrifice of works. And here, the Gita's insistence is on action. The second is jnana yoga, the self-realization and knowledge of the true nature of the self and the world. And here the insistence is on knowledge. But the sacrifice of works continues, and the path of works becomes one with, but does not disappear into, the path of knowledge. The last step is bhakti yoga, adoration and seeking of the Supreme Self as the Divine Being. And here the insistence is on devotion. But the knowledge is not subordinated, only raised, vitalized, and fulfilled. And still the sacrifice of works continues. The double path becomes the triune way of knowledge, works, and devotion. And the fruit of the sacrifice, the one fruit still placed before the seeker, is attained. Union with the divine being and oneness with the supreme divine nature. So you see, he uses the Gita to describe his own ascent into the sublimities of para-prakriti, of the divine shakti, of the divine nature. First, karma yoga. Jnana yoga follows. Last, bhakti yoga. So, the Gita suggests that knowledge and communion in work prepares us for the liberality of the heart. We must be prepared for the final consummating wave of love that establishes the entirety of our identity with the divine. And this is the course of the Gita. It begins with a summary declaration of what we have from the teaching of Vedanta, then moves to the yoga of knowledge, yoga of works, eventually the yoga of love. So, if there were interpolations, additions to the Gita over the centuries that built it from a couple of hundred verses upwards, they have been carefully inserted and ordered properly to accord to an advancing yoga. And Sri Aurobindo gives you the key to how this works in this chapter. All these three paths that lead separately to communion with the divine and liberation from ignorance can be brought together, and the entire being can be liberated. And this is what is recognized as being the grand offer to Arjuna on the field of Kurukshetra before he wades into battle with his kinsmen. To have achieved this in essence before he picks up his bow again is Krishna's aim. So, there we are. We'll take up the next chapter next Sunday. So, let's look in Savitri for a moment. Go to Book 3, Book of the Divine Mother. The House of the Spirit and the New Creation, which is Canto 3. And let's look at, I think, page 318. I know this may seem like an odd place to pick up the thread, but let's do it here. A last and mightiest transformation came. His soul was all in front like a great sea, flooding the mind and body with its waves. His being spread to embrace the universe, united the within and the without, to make of life a cosmic harmony, an empire of the immanent divine. In this tremendous universality, not only his soul, nature, and mind sense included every soul and mind in his, but even the life of flesh and nerve was changed and grew one flesh and nerve with all that lives. He felt the joy of others as his joy. He bore the grief of others as his grief. His universal sympathy upbore, immense like ocean, the creation's load, as earth upbears all beings' sacrifice, thrilled with the hidden transcendence, joy, and peace. There was no more division's endless scroll. One grew the spirit's secret unity. All nature felt again the single bliss. There was no cleavage between soul and soul. There was no barrier between world and God. Overpowered were form and memory's limiting line. The covering mind was seized and torn apart. It was dissolved, and now no more could be. The one consciousness that made the world was seen. All now was luminosity and force. Abolished in its last thin fainting trace, the circle of the little self was gone. The separate being could no more be felt. It disappeared and knew itself no more, lost in the spirit's wide identity. His nature grew a movement of the all, exploring itself to find that all was he. His soul was a delegation of the all that turned from itself to join the one supreme. Transcended was the human formula. Man's heart that had obscured the inviolable assumed the mighty beating of a god's. His seeking mind seized in the truth that knows. His life was a flow of the universal life. He stood fulfilled on the world's highest line, awaiting the ascent beyond the world, awaiting the descent, the world to save. So, namaste. Jai Ma.